Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. Going right into the show tonight, October 28th, 2010. And just a second. Wouldn't it be just like my frog in my throat to begin exactly when the show begins? October 28th, 2010. Really a lot of material to cover tonight, so right into the show with my Science Hour. Incredible weather this past week through the entire United States. Some places were missed, but not many. We had fleets of tornadoes running through Kentucky in the Southland. We had hurricane force winds on Lake Michigan and all through the Midwest. Extremely high winds, straight line winds, and gusting winds, some of the worst kind, because they pulsate. Tremendous amount of damage, electrical outages. Chicago had the worst storm in, what they say, the worst storm in 70 years, comparing it to the Armistice Day storm back in the 1930s. So I'll be talking about that and the cause of that storm. I always get a kick out of the Standard Weather Service and the National Weather Service. They say, well, yeah, we're close to November now, so these storms are normal. As if, because of the month of November is here, all of a sudden, magically, storms can happen. No. Storms happen because there is energy input into our system here, into the Earth. It's not because of the month of November or any other month. We can have storms, and I'll give examples of major storms that have happened in every month of the year. But yeah, we can have these tremendously strong northeasterly winds that come in. A lot of talk, of course, this past week also about the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, which was a result of one of those tremendous storms from the north. The Edmund Fitzgerald, of course, in song and legend, was the largest freighter carrying iron ore from the north shore of Lake Superior from Duluth up to Sault Ste. Marie to the locks. And that fateful night, two ships were out approaching the locks, I guess about 9 miles away, and one of the hatches blew off of the top of the Edmund Fitzgerald. It began taking on water. I'm not an expert on that particular wreck, but of course it eventually went down. I think it also grazed some rocks up there that were, but it basically they were running with this tremendous storm. And I saw on the YouTube, you should go and look at this if you have time. Go to YouTube and just look up the Edmund Fitzgerald, and there's a lot of associated video of those big ore freighters in Lake Superior with 50 to 70 foot waves, possibly longer or larger. These are big, big ships that carry the ore from the northern Minnesota iron mines out to down to Cleveland and Detroit where the mills are to make steel. But to see those immense ships rolling and seeing the waves coming over the backside of those ships and just completely inundating them, tossing them around like a cork in a bathtub, just incredible. So at any rate, but that was due to weather that occurs in November. So, but what causes this weather? What's the actual cause of the weather? This time we had a very strange, very interesting condition in the solar system due to, a comet that occurred, that came by, Comet Hartley. And I'll talk about that, how this comet, the relatively small comet, came behind Earth and kicked off an electrical connection. And then we have the inferior conjunction of Venus occurring right now as this storm was occurring. And that comet also helped connect us out to Jupiter electrically. So I'll be talking about how that happened. So as I say, these storms are not just, just happens to be the month of November and we can have storms now. No, that's not the case. Let me talk about a comet, Lulin, February of 2009. Comet Lulin came through the solar system and also equally caused some electrical connections in the solar system, giving us a very similar storm. Now, in my weather book, the Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun-Earth Weather, which, of course, is written for the general public and for scientists. I talk about the various types of electrical connections that can influence Earth's weather. And I got a kick. A friend of mine called me from California, and he said he was talking about the severe wind weather conditions in the Midwest. And the explanation he saw in the newspaper out there was that the jet stream had sped up and therefore was the cause of these storms and the cause of these tremendously low pressure cells that were moving across the Midwest. In my book and through historically through my commentary on radio, etc., I've coined the term himicane. A hurricane is a storm, cyclonic storm, over water. And so I said, well, logically, we should call the storms over land a himicane, right? I'm not sure why. But at any rate, that's what I call these. These are tremendous storms that form over land. And they look exactly like a hurricane. They act like a hurricane. But in this case, the storm is moving in an easterly direction. Hurricanes around the equator move westerly. And there's a reason for that. That's because the magnetically coupled jet streams in the Earth's upper atmosphere, the equatorial region, the electron stream moves westward, and in the tropical regions in the northern and the southern regions of the Earth, the jet streams move easterly. And they somewhat snake around the Earth. The jet stream in the equatorial region moves westerly. The jet streams in the north and southern hemisphere move in an easterly direction. And that's because they are magnetically coupled. The equatorial westward moving stream is electrons up in the upper ionosphere and through the upper atmosphere. The northern and southern hemisphere jet streams are primarily positive ions. And so it's a very different type of storm, but the end result is the same, high winds down here on Earth. And so, the meteorological explanation that comes out of standard science is that, oh, it's just the month of November. We can have these storms now. Well, no. Storms require energy, not fairy tales. So at any rate, what happened this time in October, around October 24th, well, let's go back to the beginning of October. Around the 9th of October, a small comet called Comet 103P Hartley, 103 Hartley, I forget the full designation, but basically it's currently in the news, but Comet Hartley came back around behind Earth in its orbit. It's in orbit in the solar system. It has about a six-year cycle in its orbit. But anyway, it came fairly close to Earth, behind Earth, and it had a fairly close electrical connection with Earth, aligning. And at that time, it had a fairly good straight shot out to Jupiter. So what happened? The comet is electrically discharging the solar capacitor. The nucleus is only a couple miles across, and by the way, November 4th is going to be one of the NASA spacecraft, the Deep Impact spacecraft that in 2005 went by Comet Temple and sent an impactor into that comet nucleus, proving that comets could not possibly be dirty snowballs. But of course, NASA's interpretation was that there is snow and ice on comets, even though that you cannot see them. But at any rate, that same spacecraft, the Deep Impact spacecraft, is going to be going by and photographing the nucleus, relatively small comet nucleus, of Comet Hartley here November 4th. And so it will be interesting to see that that scientific data if NASA releases it. That was rather comical. I was on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie one night. It was in July, I believe, of 2005, and we were going to wait for the NASA data to come in from the Comet Temple flyby of the Deep Impact spacecraft. And we waited, and NASA just didn't release it for weeks and weeks and weeks. And of course, what we found out, there was some of the data that was released. And it was very clear that my predictions regarding the electrical discharges as the plume came out of the comet, that type of thing, all were verified. And, of course, no water was found at all in the impact, just dust. And so how can you have a dirty snowball with no ice or water? Well, that's that invisible black ice that NASA has invented, I guess. But at any rate, the point is, let's get back to the current weather situation. The weather that we just saw in the United States, stretching all the way from Canada down through Texas, a big cyclonic storm, a hurricane, very much a hurricane-looking storm, occurred because, as I said, Comet Hartley around the beginning of October connected electrically with Earth, stretching out in the electrical size of Comet Hartley is millions and hundreds of millions of miles long. So that discharge extends all the way out, connecting eventually into the discharge that Jupiter has also in the solar capacitor. So basically at that time, Earth began to connect electrically with Jupiter. Now enters Venus, the inferior conjunction of Venus. I believe it was on the 24th or at least it started connecting electrically with the Earth on the 24th of October. And that's when these storms really started to develop out in the Pacific Ocean. And that's when the winds started, the hurricane-type patterns started over the United States. And tonight we're at the 28th. So those storms ranged for about 3 or 4 days as Venus now connects electrically with the Earth. Now imagine this electrical path that Earth has in the solar system. Comet Hartley connects to it, having let's estimate 100 million mile electrical tail and electrical connection going towards the sun. We connect electrically with Jupiter, which is halfway out in the solar system. Jupiter has a tremendous electrical discharge of the solar capacitor. We are now connected into that. And then later in the month, the 24th of October, Venus comes into the scene, connecting us further to the inner solar system. So Earth has a tremendously dynamic electrical connection, very distant in the solar system, way out and way in from our planet. Well, wouldn't you expect, and yes, there was a tremendous storm system. And I happen to be in the upper Midwest, experiencing 50-mile-an-hour, 60-mile-an-hour winds with gusts, probably up to that much. You couldn't drive on the road. There were no trucks. Cars were having a very difficult time driving on the roads. In Chicago, they said the winds reached hurricane velocity. In Lake Michigan, they said, yes, they had hurricane-force winds. Now, how do you have this on a planet Earth? This just because it's the month of November. As I said, Comet Lulin was February 2009, and we had a very similar hurricane type of event. So at any rate, that's the cause of the weather this past week. And I don't see any when I make my predictions in the springtime. I'm just going to bring something up here, just a second. Tonight's main science topic, I will be talking about preservation of food. And this is kind of an interesting topic because I came across a question that I had to ask myself. And as many of you know, I placed freeze-dried food on my webpage for selling. And because I just think it's time that this economic world we live in is coming apart at the seams. And the situation is, it's like a third world country. I've spent a lot of time in third world countries. And I see the conditions there where they basically have no cash available. And that's what's going on in the United States. There's not a recovery. Some people are doing good. So there are some people who are not doing too bad. So if you use that as your gauge, the economy is doing quite well. I remember back in the Iraq War, somebody asked Dick Cheney, said, They said the economy is doing terrible. People are under severe economic crisis here. And they asked Dick Cheney, what do you think about that? And he says, I don't know what you're talking about that. Everybody I know is going on all eight cylinders. Well, if you happen to have your buddy as vice president in the White House, and all of the no-contest contracts are going to your company because there's a war going on, the falsely created war, and be that as it may, but the fact is that, there are some people that are doing really well right now. But I wouldn't use that as a gauge of this society we live in. The country, I'd say two-thirds of it is folding at the seams as I speak tonight and has been. As people fall through the cracks, they simply are just no longer there. And what I've seen is that some of the last purchasing that people do is for food. Now, I had to ask myself a question. I looked up and I've studied, and there's something I knew something about before, but I've done a lot of more studying recently. The question is, what kind of food works for survival? This is the kind of food you want to store long-term, and under all types of variable conditions, it's going to last. It's going to be there for you. And so I came up with some very startling surprises for myself, things that I never imagined before. So I'm just going to go through some of the various types of preserving food tonight and talk about how they are related to survivability. Where did these types of food preservation come from? Oh, and by the way, before I forget about it, the very next show on WWCR, please note this. I have to talk about frequencies and frequency changes as we're heading into the winter months. And this is also due to some FCC, the various government agencies that govern the frequencies, the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, took away the 5070 frequency last spring. Remember, my show aired on WWCR 5.070 megahertz, and now it went to the 9.350. And so at any rate, next show, November 7th, mark this on your calendar, I will be back on frequency 5.070 megahertz with WWCR, the Thursday night show. And so November 7th, 2010, the very next show will be on 5070. And so that is coming up. And also remember that Friday night, 10 p.m. Central Time and 3 a.m. Central Time on Saturday, you can hear this show rebroadcast on 5.755 megahertz. So there's some various places to listen to this show. Just remember that, and I'll be posting that also on my webpage. So remember that next Thursday night, after November 7th, let's put it that way. Will that be the next show? No, that will not be the next show. Let me see. The 28th. The next show will be on the 9.35 frequency, and then the next show, the second show from tonight, will be on 5.070. But there is no change with the 5.755 frequency. That's Friday night. It's 10 p.m. Saturday morning at 3 a.m. Central Time. Okay, I'm glad I got that announcement in. I rather forgot that. But to start out the concept of preserving food, I want to go back to something that not many people today really lived through or know about. This is the Great Depression in the United States. Recently, interesting event occurred. A Russian researcher posted on Wikipedia a statement that in the United States, around 7 million people starved to death during the Great Depression. And it was done through the use of statistics of population statistics. But there are other studies that have been done in other documentaries. There's a movie that's out, I understand. I haven't seen it myself. It's called Dogville. And it's a story, I guess, starring Nicole Kidman, and where she's in a Depression-era town. And the very end scene of the movie is pictures of the people who had driven out of the cities, basically ran out of gas and been parked in a farmer's field and starved to death because there was no food there. And that sounds interesting, because how could you imagine that people would get to a farm someplace and have no food? Well, what really happened during that time is that the U.S. government, here was the logic that has been reported, at least, is that there were so many people out of work that the people who controlled the food would not give it away, because it would wreck their sales. If you're giving food away for free, why would people come and pay you for your food? So they, instead of selling it, because now they had an overabundance of food because people couldn't buy it, they destroyed the food. This is the logic that came out of the U.S. government. This is what happened, and as a result, millions of people in the United States starved to death. And there's really no record of it. It's like, let's take, for example, Katrina, the hurricane that came through New Orleans and Florida. There's no record. Here we are in the 2000 era, you know, with modern communication, with instant communication, satellite communication, and nobody knows what happened to about half of the population of the city of New Orleans. How could that possibly be? A couple years previous to that, we had four hurricanes rolling through central Florida. There's no record of what happened to tens of thousands of people, many of them living in trailer courts, many of them living in standard housing for Florida, which is relatively, many of the little towns have inexpensive housing. But the town's just simply missing, and no record of, did some of these people live? Did some of them leave? And with New Orleans, many of those people were bussed out of there and just simply dropped off in other places. There's no record of this. So do you think that your friendly local government is going to somehow do good by you and help you out? Let's put it that way. So there again, today we have the situation where a few people control the food, and if we got to that situation again, first of all, today we don't have the food stored that we had in previous years. Remember, it was Clinton that signed the edict to sell off all of our grain to Russia that was in storage and to other parts of the world, and basically to eliminate the stored food in the United States, making it illegal to have stored food, like the big grain silos that used to dot this great land. None of those exist anymore. Everything is just in time, so to speak. And so that puts the control of food on a very immediate basis in the hands of a few. And the same thing would happen. It would be bad for business to give away food, so therefore the food would be destroyed, as in the 1930s, where they plowed millions of acres of wheat under and killed millions of hogs and farm animals. Here's an estimate in the article that appeared in Wikipedia, which, by the way, has been taken out of Wikipedia. Now, I thought Wikipedia was for a common knowledge base contributed by everybody. Well, I guess certain topics and certain authors just aren't allowed. I thought it was funny when, there for a short time, my name was in Wikipedia, and it was covered not by anything I put in there or anybody that I know put in there. It was covered by government agents who only used it as a way to badmouth me and my work. Isn't that interesting? But then at the same time, a little bit later, the government agents went in and cleaned out anything unrelated to the Dirty Snowball Comet model. In other words, the science, the garbage science that they want to promote to the public is the only thing left in Wikipedia. So, at any rate, Wikipedia is an owned entity, just like Google. When you search on Google, what do you get? You get a bunch of government-sponsored searching. You don't get the type of search that you really need or ask for. So at any rate, let's get back to this idea that during the 1930s, it says that one out of every six farmers was affected by famine. How could this be? But as my own grandparents were forced from their farm by the local banks in out in western Minnesota. So I know that my dad ended up growing up in the little town because they were forced off the property by the bank. The bank came out and foreclosed on him, just like they did with other millions of farms around the world and around the United States. But therein lies the problem. If you had a viable economy, then the farmer would be the central point of that economy. You would have to have a strong farmer, but you can see clearly that that's not the intention of the people in charge. So at any rate, I think it's good to understand that storage of food is instrumental to any successful society. From that, I'm going to move back to the ancient Incas. The ancient Incas, now I said on my webpage, I would tell who invented the method of preserving food called freeze-drying. Basically, freeze-drying is a method of preserving food whereby you take the food, potatoes, carrots, vegetables, fruit, meat, whatever you have, and you typically cook it first if there's cooking involved, like with meat, or with vegetables and fruit, you typically don't cook that. But basically, you take all the water out, and now by freezing it and putting it in a very dry climate, where the temperature is below a triple point of water. Now, this has to do with the characteristics of water and the vapor point of water and the freezing point of water and what is known as the triple point of water. It's basically a chemical term, but the ancient Incas understood this from an empirical point of view. What happened is they would take their roots and other meats, fish, etc., and they would take them up to a high place where it would freeze and it would be extremely dry. And this caused the food to basically be freeze-dried. It was a natural process method of freezing food. So the point is that And I remember something very interesting once. I experienced this myself. I had potatoes, and when you freeze potatoes, they typically go bad if you let them thaw. But if you freeze potatoes and you put them directly into boiling water, they don't turn into mush. They act as a regular potato, so it's a very interesting phenomenon. But at any rate, the point with freeze-drying is that you remove 98% of the water in the meat or potatoes, and that allows them to be preserved. Now, with modern freeze-drying, you put them in a can, and you remove the oxygen, and you put in nitrogen, because oxygen is the element, is the gas that really is tough on food, on metals, whatever. It reacts very quickly, oxidation, with food, and so to get rid of that oxygen out of the can, you put it on nitrogen gas in there, and then seal it. That's what modern freeze-drying is. And so I want to compare this to all of the other different types of preserving foods. And this is where I got my real education, because it turns out that freeze-dried food is the only method really suitable for survival. Some people buy dehydrated foods. Well, what's wrong with dehydrated foods? First of all, they don't freeze. They have about twice the water content of the dehydrated foods have about twice the water content of freeze-dried food, and therefore you can't freeze them and thaw them. They have that freezing and thawing has the same effect as if the foods had the full water content. The freeze-dried food typically needs some level of cooking after you rehydrate it. The dehydrated food needs some level of cooking after it is rehydrated, whereas the freeze-dried food is already cooked completely, 100%. All you do is add water. You can add cold water and eat it, or you can add hot water and have it as a hot meal. But I'm going to go through this whole list of the different types of preserving food and talk about them. The first one common method is freezing. Freezing food works good, but there are some problems. If it's in a packaging situation, then you can have what's called freezer burn. It's a type of air burning of the food. It dries the food out, and it renders it really, it's kind of a, oh, I'm not sure, but the freezer burn, it's called, and basically the food is not edible after that. If you freeze food naturally out in the environment, it doesn't get freezer burn, and that's a phenomenon of modern-day freezers, and I don't quite understand it fully, but freezing food has been a method of preserving food, but typically it is only good for about 6 months. After that, the food starts to deteriorate, so freezing works well, but only for about 6 months, and that's the typical winter. For example, if you were in Alaska or far northern climate and were preserving food by freezing, then you could maintain it. There's a very interesting that happened in Siberia when the mammoths, the woolly mammoths, the mastodons, were flash frozen up then buried in the tundra. They were later dug out, some of them thousands of years later, and the meat was still as fresh as when it was frozen. So that's an indication of the type of flash freezing that can preserve food in nature. But the typical freezing process that happens in your freezer at home is, like I say, only good for about 6 months. Air drying, sun drying, and baking foods has been another method of preserving foods, but then you have to keep it somehow. And typically, with the changes in moisture, changes in temperature, changes in atmospheric conditions, air-dried, sun-dried, or just in general dried food, there again has somewhat of a shelf life, not the 30 years that you find with true freeze-dried food. Salting is another method of removing the water. All of these tend to remove water. You want to take two things away from food. You want to take water away, and you want to take oxygen away. Those are the things, the elements that deteriorate food and really destroy the food, water and oxygen. So if you can get those away from the food, you've done a lot towards preserving the food. And salting does just that. If you've ever done a salting process, for example, let's say you have a load of fresh fish that's all filleted. You put the salt a little bit on each piece of fish, and you put it in a bucket, just dry. Within, a day or so, probably less, you look in that bucket, and it's full of water. Where did all the water come? The salt draws the water out of the meat, out of the fish, out of whatever you're salting, and that's a way of also removing the water. It also makes it very difficult for fungus or any of the other types of bacteria to grow on the food. So that's one reason why salting has been favored, especially in warm climates. When the ships went around the world, the old sailing ships, salt pork, salt this, salt everything. And then, of course, before you use it, you have to unsalt it. You have to soak it in water and get the majority of that salt out so that then it's palatable, so it can be eaten. But salting food is just one other way that's been used fairly commonly throughout the world. Preservatives, other types of chemical powders and preservatives used on food or mixed in with the food, have been used to prevent rot and spoiling with food. But then, of course, you're eating the preservatives. And there again, on all of these methods, the shelf life has a limitation. Let's look at canning food. By the way, if you leave in any of these methods, if you leave more than about 3 or 4% water content in the food, if it freezes and then it thaws, the food is ruined. I had a particular experience myself with canned food. I had left some up at a campground many years ago, and I thought, gee, there's all this good food here. I won't bring a lot of food with me the next time I go to the campground. Well, this past summer, I went back there, started opening the cans, and all of the food had been destroyed simply by freezing. And it basically turns it into mush. And it's the food is just no good anymore. So canning of food is a good way to preserve it if you can maintain the temperature in the environment. And that's another thing that will destroy food is freezing and thawing, or high temperatures also will destroy food. So, for example, let's take dehydrated food, which is about 4% water content. And if it freezes and thaws, again, it's ruined. If the temperature gets too high, the food is ruined. So most of these methods of preserving food work quite well if you can maintain the temperature at a constant, somewhat room temperature, sometimes a little above if drying. Preserving the food at a little higher temperature is better, but dry, moisture-free air content with something that's frozen or like meats, sometimes a cooler temperature is a bit better. But once again, the shelf life on these is the real question. What methods are really beneficial for a length of time like 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, or up to 30 years? Let's talk about canning. This became popular in World War II when large amounts of food had to be transported. And then after World War II, canning became very popular for the household because you could take cans, can during, say, I grew up in a small town where there was a canning factory, and in the early part of the summer there was the pea canning, the canning of peas, and then in the later part of the summer, canning corn. And this corn then had to be stored, but it had to be stored in a temperature-controlled location because if it froze and then thawed, it was ruined. So canning became popular as long as you could keep the canned goods in a temperature-controlled environment. Pickling with vinegar has been around for ages. Vinegar is a form of apple juice that turns chemically, and basically it can keep air out and it's not going to change anymore. It's like wine. It's something that's going to last for a long time. So you can keep the air and the water away from food by pickling it. You basically replace the water with vinegar. And that's a method for long-term storage of food. It's been used throughout history. Smoking of food. You take food, you put it in a room or a container, and then put smoke in there. Smoke coming from the, say, a wood fire or chips, charcoal chips. And that smoking, basically, it's a way of drying the food out, getting the water out of the food, and also putting a coating of smoke, which prevents fungus and bacteria from growing on the food. So simply another way where you can take meat especially, smoke it, and then just hang it up and let it hang there for months and months. I don't know if you've ever been in a real Italian supermarket or grocery store. The grocery stores of Italy never had refrigeration, but you'd go in and you'd see everything hanging there, the pieces of meat, big sections of meat, etc., and they were all preserved. So at any rate, another method of preserving food, vacuum packing. And this is something that's become very popular in the modern world. Packaging of there are small countertop machines with very heavy plastic bags, reinforced plastic bags. You put the vegetables or the food, whatever you want to preserve, in the vacuum-packed bag. Put the end of the bag in this vacuum sealer. First, it sucks all of the air out of the bag, and then it puts a hot electrical iron, so to speak, on the open end, and seals that bag so that you have a vacuum packed. What are you doing there? You're getting the moisture and you're getting the air, the oxygen out of there. So once again, but typically if you have meat that is vacuum packed, that has to be refrigerated also. And once again, the meat, the fish, whatever, in a vacuum packed package has a very high water content. So if it freezes and then thaws, at that point you have to eat it or it goes bad. You cannot continually let it freeze and thaw. So one of the points here that I'm trying to get across is that in an emergency situation, you probably are not going to be able to control your environment. Probably, most likely, you're not going to be able to control the environment, especially where your food is stored. Some people say, well, I can bury it in the ground. Let me tell you the problem with burial of food. First of all, you have to, it's a lot of work. You have to dig a hole or a cellar. That works good up until a point. But if we're talking about the type of emergency scenarios that have occurred throughout history, especially if a large comet comes through the solar system, now your underground storage facilities tend to change temperatures and are not as viable as they used to be. In the upper Midwest, you have to dig below 4 feet into the ground to get below what they call the freeze line. That's the level of dirt at which the ground freezes on a normal winter. But if it's not a normal winter, it can freeze up to 5 to 6 feet deep. Now the next question is, how are you going to get down to your food if you've buried it? Digging through solid frozen ground is one of the more difficult things to do. So there again, trying to find a place where you can guarantee that the temperature stays above freezing is very difficult. And then if you can do that, how do you then get down to your food on a cold winter's day? Or especially if the climate itself has changed, conditions are such that you are trying to get to your food and the ground is frozen. It would take a tremendous amount of work to dig through that ground. In Hawaii, just going to another type of preservation, in Hawaii and Southeast Asia, difficult times when food was short, because these people lived by nature. They lived, there was sometimes abundance of certain things, and then all of a sudden there weren't any for the next, until the next season. Sometimes 2 to 3 years had gone by before the same food item would be available again. So what they did is they took urns, earthen urns, containers, and they would just throw everything in there, fruit, meat, fish, everything. And then they would cap it. They would cap it with a type of animal fat or oil. And there's a modern term for this same type of canning is called potting, P-O-T-T-I-N-G. You put all of your materials in a container. Many times it was cooked in the container, heated up until the whatever was in there was cooked. And then you would cap it by putting a wax or a animal fat on top, and that would preserve the food. But I understand there are some types of food that are made that way in Southeast Asia. And with a lot of, let's say, heat, a lot of high temperature, or like, what would you call peppers, that are not hot in the terms of temperature hot, but hot in terms of chemicals in the food hot. In other words, like the Mexican chili pepper, so to speak, that type of hot. And that's another method of preserving food. But basically, you put cabbage. Cabbage is one of the more popular foods to put in this. And other types of vegetables, you bake it and then seal it, and then you can leave it like that. Preservation using sugars has been popular. If you put something in honey, in sugar, or in wine, wine is actually a form of course, alcohol is a form of sugar, and preserving things in those mediums, it's also been popular. So jellies, fruits, vegetables, greens, etc., all can be preserved in sugar and wine and in honey. And once again, what does that do? It takes the oxygen, keeps the oxygen away, basically puts it in a sealed type of gel that keeps the oxygen away. Cooking in a container is a type of I was mentioning that it's called potting, and also irradiation. And I'm not sure of anybody who really in the green world, so to speak, or in the ecologically sound world, is interested in irradiating their food with nuclear irradiation. So once again, now there's probably many other methods of preserving foods, but I've hit on the primary ones. Now look at what you're trying to do. With all of these methods of preserving food, you're trying to keep the temperature change away from the food because it contains water. When water freezes and thaws, it goes through some chemical changes, but it expands and it contracts. Most other liquids do not do that. Water does. So water expanding and contracting in the cells of the food is bad. It ruins the food. It can destroy the cellular material of the food, and it's bad. That's why dehydrated food at a 4% water content is destroyed by freezing and thawing. The only method of all of these different methods of preserving food, the only method that has been time-tested and that maintains through all of these various conditions, freezing, thawing, high temperature, low temperature, atmospheric conditions, etc., the only type of food that really will last and last and last is freeze-dry food. And that's why I decided to start putting it on my webpage. It's already cooked. One of the biggest things in an emergency is you're probably not going to have the ability to cook a lot. So you would need a food that's available. And also, as far as preserving the nutrients in the food, freeze-drying has the highest food content value once you rehydrate the food. So basically, of all of the problems available in storage of food and the maintenance of the food in storage for a long period of time, freeze-drying is the only method that cuts through all of them, and it doesn't matter. You can freeze it. You can bring it down to a very low temperature. It can sit in a very elevated temperature. Of course, ideally, you don't want to do that. You want to keep it at a normal temperature. But it's the only method of food preservation that's really going to last and last up to 30 years. The other thing is that something that I noticed when I first started talking and communicating with people about freeze-dried food and my own personal experience was what you might call sticker shock. That all of a sudden you're looking at, well, let's say you're buying hamburger in a case, in a can, and you buy a number 10 can. It's the same size as one of those 3-pound coffee cans. So basically, this is what your product comes in. It has a nitrogen atmosphere in the can. It's sealed. It has a plastic cover that can reseal the can. But you're buying 6 of these in a case for $240. And so the initial thought is, boy, I could buy a lot of hamburger for $240. So it never occurred to me until just about a week ago. I was talking to some people and I thought, you know, I've got to explain to people that when you go to the grocery store, let's say you buy hamburger. Let's take three examples. You buy hamburger, you buy good steak, and you buy chicken. Boneless chicken, let's say, chicken meat. And you look at the price you pay. Now take those, and first of all, remove the water that's been put in there by the butcher. By law, they're allowed to put in 10% or more of water content, depending on the state you live in. They can put in, and they take, I don't know if you've ever seen these, but it's a big cluster of needles that goes down into the meat, and they're different lengths. basically they inject water in there, and you pay the price of meat for that water. So take away that water from the meat you buy in the store. Let's say hamburger costs $5 a pound. Let's say steak costs $7 a pound. And let's say chicken, for just the boneless chicken meat with the skin taken off and everything, just the meat, let's say you pay $5 a pound, whatever. Okay, now remove that extra 10% water that was just put in there by the butcher. Now remove the fat. Let's look at hamburger and steak. Hamburger typically has anywhere from a 25% content, maybe down to very expensive hamburger, would be about 5% fat content. But remember, for the 95% ground beef, you're not going to be paying $5 a pound. You're going to be paying $7.50 a pound, something like that. So at any rate, take out whatever you're buying, take out the fat. And that's another 5 to 25% of the weight. So now you're down to about 70% of the weight of the original thing you bought, the piece of meat that you bought. Let's say you bought 1 pound of beef, of hamburger or beef, whatever. Okay, now you've removed the excess water that the butcher put in, you've taken out the fat, and you're left with pure meat. Now cook that, and then remove the excess water, all of the water, like literally all of the water, and that's what freeze drying does. And you're left with simply the vitamins, the minerals, and the meat fiber itself. So now you're going to get down to about 22% of the meat's weight. So you just paid $5 a pound for hamburger. When you get done removing the excess butcher water, the excess fat, and the excess the natural water content of the meat, which is about 70% water, you're down to about 20% of that original pound. Now, if you look at freeze-dried and you start calculating the amount of money you pay for freeze-dried food, what happens? It turns out that you're getting a much better deal with the freeze-dried food. You're paying less per pound with freeze-dried food, and also now you can move it around. Well, that's one of the other things we've talked about in my own particular circle of friends. When you're moving things, how much of this can you move? Freeze-dried food weighs, you can pick up a can, you say, oh, that's freeze-dried because it's very light. You pick up dehydrated, and it weighs well over 2 times the amount of freeze-dried food. So now you're going to start carrying this food around or moving it possibly. What is more economical in terms of moving it and being able to get this from point A to point B if you had to? There again, freeze-dried weighs less than half the amount of dehydrated food. So all of these reasons went into my decision to put freeze-dried food on my webpage. But I think it's important to talk to people about this because we're heading into a time where I don't think people are going to be buying Christmas presents this year. I don't think they're going to be buying holiday presents or spending much money. But I think what people will start doing is looking at what they really need. And so, for example, when you start calculating how much food you're going to need over the next year, and I've actually suggested to people, and I've done this myself, and it's a very interesting experiment. I have started to use grains, natural grains like red wheat. I've started to use the flax on a daily basis, the freeze-dried food, and then freeze-dried vegetables. And all of a sudden, I don't go to the grocery store. I do go buy greens, and I go to the farmer's market. I buy fresh vegetables. I like them as much as anybody else. But the point is, I'm starting to look at the following. The other thing you need when you have freeze-dried food is you need clean water. If you're in an emergency, and that's another reason why I just felt this really rounded out the type of things that I'm promoting for the public. The type of thing that you need in case of an emergency, and that's the freeze-dried food, the water filters for clean water, I also promote people getting sprout seeds and seeds like 50-pound bags of red winter wheat or red spring wheat, the soft spring wheat or the hard winter wheat, and storing those. Also any types of beans and rice, those type of things. But the one thing that, once again, dehydrated food, you cannot get meat in dehydrated food because it doesn't last. The only way you're going to get meat and therefore protein is to have it freeze-dried and have it, that's the only way you can preserve it for a long period of time. So once again, that's just what I'm encouraging people to do is live as if you were a survivalist. And I don't consider myself a survivalist at all. I've been in survival situations. I've lived in the tropics, in the jungles. Basically, I've lived up in the northern climates. I've lived in central Canada for months and months at a time during the winter with no supplies at all, just the myself and what was available locally in nature. And so I know how to survive, but I don't consider myself a survivalist. I consider myself a rational person. And I think that anybody that out there that really has interest in maintaining should be a person who looks at what they have, the way they take care of themselves, their health, etc. And I just found it very interesting that the Andeans, the Incas of the Andes, were the ones who developed freeze-dried food. It is said they had anywhere from 3 to 7 years of food stored at any given time, and that's what allowed them to succeed as a society through the times when other societies would come and go. And where my latest book, The Diamond Principle, I talk about such things, where societies have to make decisions. And in our society today, we, our governments, are not making good decisions, so the individuals have to make these decisions for themselves. I'm just about out of time here. This is Jim McCanny, and let me give my webpage, JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com, JMCC, SCI.com, and make sure you go there, and right now, from now till Christmas, I'll be promoting a lot of the science, the Diamond Principle book that I believe everybody should read. And also just self-preservation. How are you taking care of yourself? This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.